Great. The next case on the court's Zoom calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Joseph John Hall, case number A230122. We are ready for arguments on behalf of Mr. Hall. Would counsel introduce himself for the record and proceed with argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. Charles Clippert, CLIPPERT, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Joseph Hall. And Mr. Hall was convicted of failing to register as a predatory offender following a court trial and was sentenced to an executed term of 24 months. He had a prior, so that 24-month sentence was we call it a mandatory minimum. It wasn't quite a hard mandatory minimum, but it was a mandatory minimum sentence. And the issues really are two for this panel to consider. First, whether the district court erred when it denied Hall's request for an intoxication instruction or intoxication defense. And second is whether there was a basis for a mitigated durational or dispositional departure, excuse me.
Counsel,
and
can we just talk about that first issue? So you started off by saying that this is an appeal following a court trial. And so when I read the district court's in limine order, it grants the state's motion in limine to not give a jury instruction. And the defendant in this case has waived his right, or the appellant in this case waived his right to a jury trial. So I'm not quite certain how we even get to the statutory interpretation issue because there wasn't a jury.
Sure, you're right, but I think the limine motion should be seen as precluded the defense from offering the defense of intoxication, voluntary intoxication.
And then how is that the case? Because when I read the trial transcript and I am focused on the testimony of the treatment director and the responding officer and the cross-examination of those two witnesses, where there was pretty substantial testimony about your client's levels of intoxication during that period of time when he did not register. And the district court then made factual findings about that testimony and then ruled that in its view, the evidence did not support an intoxication defense. So how do we get here?
Well, again, Your Honor, because I think it handcuffed the defense in the presentation of additional evidence about Mr. Hall's level of intoxication.
So was something, I didn't see in the transcript, was there something that was attempted to be offered and then there was an objection? I didn't see any rulings excluding or prohibiting the defendant from introducing evidence.
And I guess, Your Honor, it seems that the limine motion was taken as if it were a jury trial, and that evidence should not have been presented to the jury or to the fact finder, whether the fact finder is the jury or a court.
Okay, so even if that's true, and let's assume that that's true, the fact that the evidence was actually presented during the trial, does that indicate that any error in the district court's in limine motion, in limine order, would be harmless?
Yes, because it seems like the district court said the fact finder can't consider voluntary intoxication as a defense to the underlying charge. By the court granting itself that limine motion, the court was precluding itself from considering the voluntary intoxication defense.
Counsel, and I could be wrong. My recollection is even when we have a case where there was a jury trial and an instruction was denied, such an error could be harmless. If the record shows that even if the instruction were given, it wouldn't have made a difference. So, I mean, I'm struggling with how this was prejudicial error, even though the district court said you can't give this instruction, which implies you can't have the defense, but the district court heard and received evidence about intoxication and made findings, I think, about intoxication. I mean, and if we can look at all that and say this wouldn't have produced a different result with a jury, isn't it harmless?
And that's Mr. Smith made that argument that even if the error to not give the instruction was an error, that there wasn't enough evidence to sustain the intoxication defense. And boy, I have a hard time because a lot of times I think we're projecting maybe like a weekend of college weekend of binge drinking onto what was going on with Mr. Hall. But I think especially when we get to the dispositional advisor's report, we've learned that Mr. Hall suffers from a schizoaffective disorder. He's got depression. He's got a TBI. He's got PTSD. He was diagnosed with alcohol use as a severe disorder. So I don't think we're in a situation where someone's drinking and then kind of waking up the next morning with a bad hangover. He's drinking and going on a binge. And I, for example, I had a client who killed his girlfriend over a vodka bottle, and they would go on 5-6 day drinking binges, and they would soil themselves because they would not care to move. They would just get, they would almost plan it out. And so if that's where Mr. Hall is in these binge drinking, or not binge drinking in his level of intoxication, then that might be enough. But again, it doesn't seem like the district court was considering that defense.
Mr. Clipper, let me to follow up on these questions. So the district court, the statute that sets forth the offense required him to register 5 days before he changed his primary residence. That would have been, I think, the last 5 days that he was at the Unity House. The statute also requires that he give notice immediately after he's no longer staying at the registered address. But I think we probably can assume he was sober while at the Unity House. But isn't that evidence of his failure to give notice to re-register within the last 5 days at the Unity House sufficient to sustain the conviction, in which case his voluntary intoxication after going to the hotel would be irrelevant. And by the way, in the district court, I mean, specifically in the conclusions of law of page 6 of the final order, the district judge relied on, both made findings that support that conclusion and then used that exact reasoning. So doesn't that basically mean that his voluntary intoxication after arriving at the hotel is irrelevant?
If I remember correctly in the record, I think the Red Roof Inn was supposed to be a temporary placement for Mr. Hall, and was only, I don't think the record showed that it was a 5-day window for him to give that as a change of address. I think if I remember it, he was pretty much taken out of the Unity House and brought right to the Red Roof Inn without a 5-day window to actually update his address with the BCA. So I don't know whether that window is sufficient. I guess if he had time afterward, I guess the argument is the minute he put his suitcase down and at the Red Roof Inn, he should have updated his registration, but that may not have been his primary address at the time. So if it's a temporary address, I don't think he has to update his registration to that. So I think there's some ambiguity about what the term of stay was going to be at this Red Roof Inn. So think there's a valid.
I'm sorry too. But the district court, I think, made findings and made legal reasoning in the conclusions of law so the guilty verdict is premised on his failure to give that notice 5 days before. And you're not challenging that on appeal, I don't think, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't raise it, so no. I mean, if that's, and if the court is satisfied with the conclusions of law and findings of fact, then and that voluntary intoxication was never a viable defense, then you affirm. I think that's the way this court would have to go. But I guess, again, I think with the record showing that the Red Roof Inn wasn't a primary address and there may not have been a 5-day window to change the registration, I still think that there's room for an intoxication defense. Just turning real quickly to the sentencing, and I recognize that I'm battling a very difficult standard of review and the denial of the dispositional departure motion. One thing that was really interesting to me was the discussion the district court had with the client about how he would spiral every 4 or 5 months into a depression, or he would, his schizoaffective disorder would take over. What's sort of challenging for me here with that is, you know, Mr. Hall is never going to get better. He's never going to be fixed. You know, he's going to be struggling with these addiction issues the rest of his life. And the position he was at the time of sentencing was, is that he had more insight into his situation than he's ever had before. He had support systems in place to help him if he did start to spiral. And it seemed that he was in as good a spot as any to be rehabilitated into the community. And I admit that none of the pleadings specifically referenced 609.1055, but certainly the sentencing transcript notes the defense attorney alludes to that statute by saying he does suffer from a persistent and serious mental illness, which, you know, copies the language from the statute. So this seems to be one of those situations where Mr. Hall was in a good spot. Unfortunately for Mr. Hall, his release date is February 5th of 2024. If this court takes 90 days to issue an opinion, he's going to be out on supervised release and on a 10-year conditional release term. So that all may be moot for Mr. Hall, but maybe it means something for someone else down the road. So with that, Your Honor, we'd ask the court to either grant Mr. Hall a new trial or, even though it's almost moot, to grant him that dispositional departure. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the state. Would you introduce yourself for the record again this morning and present your argument?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith. I'm a special assistant Nobles County attorney, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. As the court's questions have hinted, that any alleged error in the district court's refusal to give a voluntary intoxication jury instruction in this particular case, even assuming that it would be appropriate, which the state doesn't concede, would have been was harmless, because as a couple of you have pointed out, the district court heard evidence about the appellant's level of intoxication. It considered that evidence, as its written findings of fact and verdict reflect, and it determined that there was no way that, based on the evidence that was presented, that appellant could have been so intoxicated for 17 days that he didn't know of his obligation to update his registration information. And in light of those facts, any error in the refusal to give an instruction was harmless. It didn't significantly affect the outcome of the case, because the court ended up hearing the evidence. I think defense counsel even essentially made the argument in closing argument, and the district court, acting as the finder of fact, rejected that argument.
To be fair, Mr. Smith, I think Mr. Klippert's argument is that the effect of the district court's in limine order was a strong signal that it did not believe that voluntary intoxication was an issue at all, and that order somehow affected the ability or the trial strategy or the ability to present evidence on what the appellant considered to be his defense to this case. Do you want to comment on that?
But certainly, I think what we have there is a lot of speculation on appellant's counsel's part. And what we don't have is proof in the record. Appellant certainly could have made an offer of proof as to what evidence he would have presented to support his voluntary intoxication defense beyond what was in the record. That would have allowed him to make some argument that the failure to give the instruction, especially in the context of this court trial, was not harmless, because had he been allowed to present the evidence he intended to present, he could have, this is the evidence and this is what it would have shown. But here we're stuck with the evidence that we have that was taken at trial. And that evidence did involve evidence of the defendant's intoxication at the relevant time. And the district court simply discounted that evidence, basically rejected it as amounting to a voluntary intoxication defense in so many words. That I think that's abundantly clear from the written findings of fact and order. So had there been an offer of proof, I think then maybe we'd be in a different position here. The defendant never made any offer of proof, and there's no evidence to allow this court to kind of to actually make a decision on what would have been different about the trial had the court allowed the instruction. There's no evidence about how this affected the trial strategy whatsoever. And in fact, like I said, that evidence was presented and elicited, and the state didn't object to the elicitation of the evidence. In fact, the prosecutor actually elicited some of the evidence about the nature of the intoxication. So any error simply was harmless. And even before that, I think as a matter of statutory interpretation, it's abundantly clear that voluntary intoxication is not an available defense to the crime of failure to register. What we have is a crime that only has to be knowing. It doesn't require a specific intent not to register. That what we have is a crime of omission, not a crime of commission. The state isn't required to prove that you intentionally didn't register. It's only required to prove that you knew of the obligation to register and then failed to do so, whether through intent or inadvertence. All that matters is the failure and the knowledge, not the defendant's intent. Certainly, it's a general intent crime. It has to be voluntary. But as the court's well aware, voluntary intoxication isn't a defense to general intent crimes. It's only a defense to specific intent crimes. Given that, given the fact that the statute 243.166 doesn't use the words intent, with intent to, or any recognized form or synonym of intent, appellant in arguing that this is a specific intent crime is essentially asking this court to add words to the statute that aren't there. And as this court's well aware, that's not this court's province. That's the province of the legislature. If the legislature wanted to make this an intentional crime, it knew well how to do so, and it didn't. It simply required intent. Not intent, I'm sorry. It simply required knowledge of the requirement to register and nothing more. If there are no other questions on the question of voluntary intoxication, I'll touch briefly on the question of the departure. The fact is that even if there are substantial and compelling grounds that would justify a departure, the district court wasn't required to grant one. In particular, I would note that this was a second conviction, and that's why we have this longer mandatory minimum sentence. There's no evidence in the record that would support a conclusion that the appellant is particularly amenable to probation. There's no evidence in the record to show that this offense was substantially less serious than the typical offense. And to the extent that the appellant now argues that he should have received a departure under 609.10.55, I would note that in the filings at the sentencing hearing, appellant never identified another appropriate supervised alternative living program having a mental health treatment component to which he should be sentenced rather than prison. In fact, his plan, as I noted in my brief, was simply to go home. And it may well be by the time of trial, he was doing relatively well. But that by itself doesn't justify a departure under 609.1055. There has to be some argument that there's an appropriate supervised alternative living program. Appellant didn't even make any recommendation or suggestion as to what that program would be. I don't know how the district court could have abused its discretion by not sentencing the appellant to a program he didn't even propose, didn't even ask for. He simply has to be placed on probation and to be able to live at home. That's not a proper request under 609.1055. That argument was never presented to the district court and therefore is not properly before this court. As the court's well aware, and as Mr. Clippert acknowledged, this isn't the kind of case where this court should exercise its limited ability to reverse a presumptive sentence. The district court did nothing wrong by sentencing the appellant to the presumptive mandatory minimum sentence of 24 months in prison, and appellant has identified no basis for overturning that ruling. For those reasons, unless the court has any other questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm both the conviction and the sentence. Thank you.
I don't see any questions coming in from the panel, so we'll return to Mr. Clippert for his rebuttal argument.
And I just would like to correct one part of the record. There is a dispositional report that was submitted at docket number 95. On page 4 of that report, there's a specific recommendation to say that his records reflect that he would be a good candidate for the adult rehabilitative mental health services, adult mental health services via human service, and intensive residential treatment services. So the request of the district court wasn't just to send him home. I mean, it was to keep him in the same programming that he was in that was helpful and provided him with the insights and the support that he needed to maintain his sobriety. So again, I recognize I'm up against a very difficult standard of review, but I would take issue with this statement that there was no plan for him other than to return home. There was, it was laid out in this dispositional advisor's report. So with that, I would again just ask that this court grant Mr. Hall some relief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes this hearing.